Have you seen Chuck Norris lately? He's still kicking butt and staying active well into his 80s. What's even more shocking is he looks more jacked than ever and seems to have more energy than guys half his age. And it's all thanks to Morning Kick, a revolutionary new daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions that combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. Just mix with water, stir, and enjoy. Unlike other green drinks out there, this one tastes exactly like strawberry lemonade and has hundreds of five-star reviews. Go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 for up to 44% off your regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 today. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Results can vary.
At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.
What's up, Open Floor Globe? This is Ben Golver with the Washington Post. I am joined on the other line by Michael the Pod Pina of Sports Illustrated. Michael, I found myself spending the weekend kind of counting my blessings and looking for silver linings a little bit. You know, we're here within the, you know, basically less than a month remaining in the regular season, but we're kind of spinning our wheels, waiting for some stars to come back, analyzing other stars that have come back. You know, guys like Kevin Durant and Anthony Davis come to mind, and yet we're still waiting on James Harden, LeBron James, and some of the other contenders, you know, big-time players to get back into the lineup for this playoff push. And I think one of the silver linings I realized, and I've been thinking about here over the last week or two, is that, you know, one byproduct of all just the tumultuous nature of this season, with it being condensed and shortened and so many guys in and out because of injuries and protocols and everything else, is that the awards races are just phenomenal. And I think you and I have hinted at some of the really fun debates that we're going to have down the road about all NBA and some of these other awards. But one I think that might have slipped under the radar just a little bit is Coach of the Year. I don't know if you agree with me, but I see at least five pretty strong candidates for Coach of the Year this year. And I think part of that is just because there haven't been as many games. There's a little bit more fluctuation. And, you know, some teams have really been able to overperform preseason expectations, depending on how well they can handle, you know, the weirdness of this season and everything else. So I thought we would go through, hopefully, what will be a pretty vigorous debate about this award, nominate our favorites, and kind of debate, hey, who deserves real recognition this year in what's got to be a super challenging year to coach NBA players. What do you think?
I was born to discuss and debate Coach of the Year, Ben.
Do you agree with me, though? This is an unusually deep crop of candidates. I mean, I feel like conventional wisdom usually surrounds like one or two guys, and this year there's more people at the table. So let me just give you some names, and you know, you can kind of, you know, either groan or give thumbs up as I go to, you know, see if we're kind of in the same ballpark. I mean, obviously, when you've got the best team in the league record-wise, you've got to be in the mix, so that's Quinn Snyder. I think Monty Williams in Phoenix, you know, they've got to be one of the biggest stories to kind of enter into this contender conversation. I'm not sure if I view them as a real contender, the Phoenix Suns, but the fact that they're not like a fringe bubble play-in type team is a massive victory. He's got to be in the mix. I think Tom Thibodeau and the New York Knicks, we kept waiting for them to fade. You kept taking shots at them all season long, Michael, and yet they've proven you wrong through the grace of Tibbs. He's got to be in the mix. I actually think a guy who I was crushing earlier this season for various in-game decisions and, you know, how he was juggling things, Steve Nash. I think he's got to be a candidate with the Brooklyn Nets. And I think politely I will include Doc Rivers because, I mean, frankly, everyone's campaigning these days in Philly, whether it's Embiid for MVP, Simmons for Defensive Player of the Year, Tobias Harris for All-Star. We might as well campaign on behalf of Doc Rivers, just kind of cut him off at the pass before he does it for himself. It seems like it's going around there big time in Philadelphia, Michael. Those are five guys I think have a shot. Would you want to throw anyone else into that mix, or do you see anyone who I listed that just doesn't really have a shot? What do you think?
So before I list my names, and I think we have a bunch of overlap here, but I am truly stunned that you have Steve Nash on your list. Like, I saw that, and then I bolded it because I was like, I need to ask Ben about this. So please, like, can you... You were very, very, very harsh on Steve Nash. I know it was months ago, and a lot has happened since, but can you please go a little bit deeper into kind of your thought process with including him here?
Well, you know, I'm the guy on this show that actually values winning, unlike you. You know, it's really hard to capture empty stats for coaches, Michael. I know that some of your favorite players might be going out there putting up these stat lines that don't mean a thing, but all that really matters is winning. And I value winning a lot. I think it's difficult to, you know, even coach stars, it's its own challenge, right? And so with Steve Nash, I'm saying if they finish with the best record in the Eastern Conference and they've had their three stars together for like six or seven games all year, and they had to handle a midseason trade, and they had to handle Kevin Durant's first season with the Brooklyn Nets, and they had to handle Kyrie Irving and his personal absences, and they had to handle multiple injuries for Kevin Durant, plus multiple contact tracing episodes, and they, you know, turned over half their roster and had to bring together a new identity on the fly, and they lose LaMarcus Aldridge. I'm not saying this guy is, you know, John Wooden or, you know, Red Auerbach or something like that, but there's a real skill there in managing personalities, and I just think he was the right guy for this show. The go-with-the-flow Steve Nash is exactly what this group needed. Who cares who they start on a given night? They'll just throw out five random people. I think they have the most starting lineups this season of any team in the league. And I think it's just the right fit. You know, the one thing that we were always giving Nash credit for was his ability to connect to the superstars, right? And kind of be a culture coach. And when you have a lot of talent, that's sort of what you need. And so I think people will nitpick Nash and say, well, of course he's going to win games. He's got all this talent. He hasn't had it night in, night out. And there really hasn't been the big inconsistencies and swings of quality of play from that group. It's amazing when you compare how many games they've lost from their star players to like Philly or Milwaukee, for Brooklyn still to be above them in the standings and to play such a distinct basketball style of basketball. I think it says, you know, speaks very highly of Nash and his impact. And here's one way I would frame it. If you swapped Tibbs and Nash, I could actually see both situations being disasters, right? Like if Nash is the guy who's got to like coach up this gritty New York Knicks team to have this amazing defense, or he's like, you know what? Screw defense. Let's just go ahead and like try to, you know, turn this into an all offense showcase around Julius Randle. That's going very poorly, and the Knicks are probably not where they are right now in the playoff picture. At the same time, would Tibbs have the right personality to handle all the craziness day-to-day that's taken place in Brooklyn, or would there be friction there with the main personalities? I think it's a fair question both ways, and that's why I wanted to give Nash his credit. I'm not going to pick him as coach of the year, but I think he needs to be in this mix. Did I sell you?
I think that he's faced some adversity in his very first year as a head coach, as you outlined. The fact that Harden...
Some adversity, Kyrie, Michael. Kyrie almost disappeared there. Like, you know, that was a pretty big deal.
Okay, yeah. I mean, okay, he has James Harden, he has Kevin Durant, he has Kyrie Irving. All these guys have been playing, when they are healthy enough to play, like, playing phenomenal basketball. The defense is still 24th in the league. They got every single buyout candidate possible to join them. They have...
He's a great recruiter, Michael. Don't you say Coach Cal in Kentucky is a great coach, right? I mean, come on. Steve Nash is out there making the calls.
Ridiculous plethora of three-point shooting during a season where, like, offense just is everything, and they run fast, and they just switch everything on defense. And he has Mike D'Antoni as an assistant, lead assistant coach. So, I like, you know, I he does not crack my top five, like, he didn't even cross my mind, to be honest with you. But
fair enough, like, honestly. But I do think he's an interesting candidate.
Yeah, and well, you make a really...
I do just want to clarify. One of the things I had the hardest time with him early in the year was the late game plays and like when to take timeouts and who should be inbounding the ball and where do you go with the final play and all that. And that's a situation where a lot of that's been cleaned up. You know, their late game record is much better. You know, as they've kind of, he's gotten his feet wet, and especially since Harden was there and just kind of did everything and solved it all for him. So again, if you want to nitpick Nash, you could say, well, you know, some of this team's key strengths really have nothing to do with coaching. It's just guys going out there and hooping and experienced all-star level players solving problems for him. But to me, like, the rookie stuff that really bothered me early on has bothered me less. And he's gotten good minutes from all sorts of different role players. And I do think that's, you know, something in his favor as well. I mean, you and I have kind of glowingly spoken about Brown, you know, and Claxton and Joe Harris, and even Jeff Green's given them some good time and all this different stuff. And, you know, again, that goes back to coaching and culture and environment. And maybe it's a more of a touchy-feely approach. And it's not what we really think of when we think of, like, coach of the year, like Nick Nurse, like playing his guitar and like getting deep into like basketball philosophy. It's a little bit of a different vibe. I mean, for God's sake, Steve Nash is dancing on TikTok. Not too many NBA coaches dancing on TikTok. But I think that it has been the right fit here. And you can't argue with the results.
Can't argue with the results. And your point about fit is brilliant when talking about Tibbs and Nash and how it would have just been an absolute train wreck for both teams if they were to swap jobs. Like that is really hilarious to consider what Tom Thibodeau would look like in Brooklyn with that roster.
It's hilarious to consider, you know, James Dolan and Steve Nash, you know, sitting across the table from each other at a boardroom meeting. I'm sure that would go great.
Yeah, so I don't have Nash, and I don't have Doc Rivers either on my list.
Oh, Michael. Yeah. Okay, don't tell me you're going to do Brad Stevens or something ridiculous.
I do not have Brad Stevens.
Okay, all right. So why not Doc? I mean, look, again, Doc is a trickier one for me. He was fifth, and the reason why is his results, unless they win the East, his results aren't going to be as good as like Quinn Snyder in Utah, right? There hasn't been some crazy radical transformation for them. Offense is still okay. It looks better. You know, the chemistry is better than last year for sure, but it's still not amazing. Defensively, they were always great, and there he is again. I look at Doc's biggest you know, achievement in Philadelphia, and I was kind of alluding to this earlier. I feel like he's just the hype man. Like he's just, you know, reinstilled confidence to a group that just really needed it. I mean, that exit from the bubble was just so sad and pathetic last year, and they've really come back with some swagger. And I think Doc, you know, that's one of his biggest attributes is, you know, building his players up, letting them know what their roles are, and then just hyping them relentlessly to the media. And I think there's actually real value in that, especially this season where everything's just tough and people are going through this grind and not loving life. So, again, that's not going to win him Coach of the Year in my book, but it's worth acknowledging.
I love Doc. If you kind of look at the differences that the changes that he's made in his first year in Philly, like he's playing the starting lineup way more. I mean, Philly plays a higher percentage of their minutes with their starting five than any other team in the league. That was the opposite of where they were in the past under Brett Brown, where they were staggering very aggressively with Joel and Ben Simmons and some of the other pieces there. But also it's just like, I don't know, the big difference to me is Joel Embiid's individual improvement. And you could definitely look at Doc and say that Doc helped him in various ways. But also like the personnel, like, yeah. You know.
I mean, Morey might have as well too, right? I mean, when we're looking at shot selection and exactly how to attack and things like that, I would almost give the front office some of the credit and attention for Embiid's improvement on that front. And I would also, by the way, give Embiid the credit first. I always want to do that when it comes to players.
100%. So if Doc is coaching Al Horford as his power forward, I think it's a little bit of a different situation. So he didn't make my cut, but I do love Doc.
Okay, so I had three guys who did make your cut. Is that right? It sounds like Quinn Snyder, Tibbs, and Monty Williams. Is that right?
Yeah, in order, I have...
Well, don't give me the order, but give me the other two that you had in your top five that I did.
I have Taylor Jenkins.
Yes, totally agree.
Memphis. He's been tremendous. I did not expect Memphis to be good this year. They're basically a lock to make the play-in. I mean, they just have such a clear identity defensively. They haven't had Jaren Jackson Jr. basically the entire season. He's their second best player. And they're just really good and feisty, and he takes advantage of his depth, and they play just a really definable, clarified style of basketball that really works and fits their personnel. So I got to tip my cap to Taylor Jenkins. He's done a tremendous job.
I'm so glad you brought him up because I was thinking about this. I don't know what you would call it. Maybe it's like the NBA League Pass Alert Awards or just the Dork Awards or something to kind of reflect, you know, guys who aren't actually going to win it, but deserve and have commanded the respect of kind of diehards around the league who are really, you know, watching this season unfold. I feel like that's Taylor Jenkins's award, and maybe for the second year running, right? Like, to me, I don't hear really hardly anyone ever talking about him or the Grizzlies, and yet rock solid. I don't know if you watched their games against Portland over the last couple of days. I mean, it was not the, oh, Damian Lillard's the best player on the court. He's just going to take everything over now that it's like time to push for the playoffs. It was the Grizzlies smacking the Blazers in the mouth twice in 3 days. And John Morant just going loco all over the Blazers' defense. But they do it by committee. They do it by team. It's really not the John Morant show. He's awesome. I love Ja, and I do see him as a future All-Star in the very, very near future. But he's getting contributions from 8 or 9 guys. They play smart, and they play super-duper hard. Like, Jonas Valanciunas, this entire chapter of his career I never saw coming. A guy who's had so many twists and turns comes in with all-star expectations. Then it seems like he's going to be a dinosaur and get played off the court because he's too slow to move defensively. Then he has this great resurgence in Memphis, just giving them amazing minutes, multiple years, and big-time stats as well. Just a lot of little wins adding up to a really, really solid and fun team to watch. You know, Taylor Jenkins, to me, is there going to be a contender that maybe poaches him at some point, like kind of tries to find a way to sneak him and get them into a higher profile job? Could you ever see that happening for him?
That's an interesting question. I mean, I think that Memphis has such a really talented young core that, you know, if everybody stays together, like you just said, a contender would poach. Like, why can't Memphis be a contender in a few years? I think they definitely have the pedigree and the pieces. It'll be really interesting to see how kind of all those guys coalesce and grow together. The one stat that I'll just throw at you about Taylor Jenkins that makes his Coach of the Year candidacy so impressive to me is, guess who on the Memphis Grizzlies leads them in total shots this season?
Leads them in total shots. Is it the Oregon Gunner, Dylan Brooks?
It is Dylan Brooks. He has attempted 836 field goals. Ja Morant is at 780. Yeah.
Well, he's had second thoughts on zero of those attempts.
Exactly. So, like, if Dylan Brooks is leading your team in shots and you're going to make the playoffs, or at least the play-in in the Western Conference, like, you deserve, like, you're doing a good job. You know what you're doing.
And I should add a little, down the stretch of that last game against Portland, I mean, Brooks is just jacking shots in some really inopportune moments, you know, with like 15 left on the clock when they're trying to milk it down and Grayson Allen's making mistakes left and right. I mean, look, they're not a perfect team by any stretch. I don't want to oversell it, but they are really fun to watch, and they've got an awesome fan base too. But your point is very well taken. Like, that is, if you had to rank the leaders, the team leaders in field goal attempts for this season, he might be the least famous, or like bottom two or three least famous, maybe.
Yeah, absolutely. And in a couple of years, he'll probably lead the entire NBA. So my next coach is, I don't know how you're going to feel about this one, to be honest.
Nate McMillan. But,
no, not Nate McMillan.
Really? Although Nate McMillan.
I can't give Coach of the Year to someone who, like, hasn't been a head coach the whole season.
Well, you're going to blame Nate for that? Don't you think he should have been head coach before the season started if these are the results?
I think there's some other factors there. So I'm not going to just turn this into a crap on Lloyd Pierce session, but when Atlanta is healthy, Atlanta is very good. And Nate McMillan, to his credit, has implemented a couple changes, but it's been hard to make changes on the fly, during this really weird season where there's no practices at all. So, you know, some of it is circumstances that are kind of just playing into Nate McMillan's favor, and some of it is coincidence, and some of it is, yeah, his temperament and his disciplinary approach has been really good for the Atlanta Hawks. So I can't give it to him, but I will say that he's done a really good job in his role there.
Yeah, he probably, if he won it, he'd need to thank Bogdan in his first sentence, right? It's like, I'd like to thank my wife, my kids, and Bogdan Bogdanovic for really coming along here. I'm really trying hard to get into your head to see who you would nominate. Sometimes I can't tell if you make your picks just to anger me. Like, please don't tell me it's Steven Silas or something like that.
It's not Steven Silas.
Okay, is it Ty Lue?
Wow, it is Ty Lue.
Hey,
yes.
I did it. There we go.
So I chose Ty Lue because, you know, this team somehow had championship expectations combined with, like, mass skepticism that they could win the championship after how they flamed out in the bubble. They had to integrate a bunch of new players, important pieces, were in and out of the lineup all year.
Let me underline that real quick. I mean,
okay,
the Clippers flamed out so badly, they gave me trust issues. I don't trust anyone anymore, Michael. I mean, nobody. You know, everyone wants to say, do you trust Paul George in the playoffs? I don't trust anyone, period, after what the Clippers did in the playoffs last summer. Doesn't matter. I don't trust you, Michael. Don't trust my own parents.
There you go then. Okay. So that helps my case here for Ty Lue. Comes on for this team that has just obliterated your ability to trust other members of your species. And the LA Clippers right now have one fewer win than the Utah Jazz. They're number two in net rating also this season. They've been really, really good. And he just deserves a ton of credit because that was the hardest, arguably the hardest job that any new head coach was taking, even though he was an assistant there last season, which maybe even could have made it harder for him to just slide over a seat and kind of take over.
Totally. No, it did. It absolutely did because of his relationship with Doc. And then also the fact that you've got to try to kind of win this locker room, which is bringing back a lot of the same personalities that just went through this kind of traumatic situation together. On top of that, you're dealing with maybe the most demanding owner in the NBA at this point, right? I mean, mm-hmm. I don't think most owners would have fired Doc last summer, do you? Or at least, you know, quote unquote, parted ways, bought him out at the amount of money that Doc still had owed on his contract during a pandemic. I mean, I think that there's very few owners who would have actually played that how Steve Ballmer played it. And that sends a message to everyone that it's like, look, results are the only thing that matters. That tone I was using earlier, Michael, to kind of mock you about winning and all this, you know, no moral victories, like that is Steve Ballmer through and through. Tough spot for Ty Lue to step into, and the results have been incredible, and they've been really good recently. I still don't trust them, but I do want to give them credit for their season, and I'm sure you agree with me, both Kawhi and Paul George need to be all NBA selections this year, correct?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, Kawhi's probably going to be on my MVP ballot. He's tremendous. But yeah, so Ty Lue, I had to put him on here.
Well argued. I agree with you, actually. So now we've got our top threes, though, correct?
Yeah. Yep.
All right, give me your number three.
I'm going Monty Williams.
Hey, that's my number three as well. Okay, make the case.
I mean, like, I don't think anybody, you know, like, me coming to this season, you know how high I was on Phoenix. Like, I think I said at one point on one episode that I could see them finishing third or fourth in the West, and you laughed at me.
Oh, yeah, no, my brain probably did not compute and just sort of short-circuited. And yet they're better than third or fourth.
Yes. Right now they are in second. They are just a really good basketball team. I mean, they're fourth in net rating, fifth in defense, seventh in offense. And they have, I mean, just because you add Chris Paul doesn't mean that all of a sudden you become an elite basketball team. I mean, he's like a 35, 36 year old point guard who's 6 feet tall, if that. And so really carrying over the performance that they had in the bubble where they go undefeated, and, you know, he needs to help develop DeAndre Ayton. They need to develop Mikal Bridges, and they need to add Chris Paul and make it so that Chris Paul and Devin Booker don't, you know, claw each other's eyes out at any point during the season, which, like, there's totally an alternate universe where that happens. It is. So for everything to have gone as smooth as it has, you just got to credit Monty Williams and the way that they've performed and the way that they've exceeded expectations, which I think is just a humongous part of Coach of the Year. Like, you got to give Monty his props.
I'm with you, and it's been a two-year turnaround that started when he showed up, right? I mean, he inherited a disaster, a mess, constant changing rosters, you know, core pieces, coaches getting fired every couple of years, no direction, you know, really rough front offices and everything else. And Monty has been the stabilizing piece, and he does it his way. I mean, compassionate, understated, focus on communication, heart-to-heart talks, you know, man-to-man honesty. Mm-hmm. That's the Monty Williams way. It's been that way since he was an assistant coach back in Portland when I was first covering the Blazers. He hasn't changed at all. You know, he is so true to himself, and it's great to see the success that he's gotten here. I mean, this is easily the most successful season he's ever had, and his pairing with Chris Paul was just, you know, that fit like a glove, and it's worked so well for Phoenix. So I had him third. Look, if they finish with the best record in the West, I think that I would give it to him. You know, I mean, that would kind of put me over the top. That race has not been decided, so the Coach of the Year race probably should remain undecided as well. But, you know, the jump that they've made from middle of the pack in that West standings to very near the top during the regular season is rare. I mean, we don't see that very often in one season, especially, you know, given where they were 2 years ago, the kind of, you know, back-to-back jumps that they make, it has been insane and definitely not something that I predicted when they hired him. Surely I thought, you know, to be honest, when they hired him, I felt bad for him. I was like, Monty, don't do this to yourself. You know, like, there's going to be another job out there. Like, you know, this isn't a destination. And, you know, they've kind of turned it into that. You know, they've given it a real culture. You know, fantastic work by Monty Williams. Who is your number two?
So my number two is my number one for most of the season. And then when we actually, when you sent me the outline for today's episode and I actually started to go over it and put my list together, my number one for every day leading up to today was bumped to number two. And that is Quinn Snyder.
Why'd you get it wrong, Michael? You had it right. You had it right all season long. We get to the moment of truth and you're going to choke the free throw, Michael. Come on.
So I have a great case for my number one, but I mean, the case for Snyder number two is just like, I don't even really need to sell anybody. Like, Utah from wire to wire has basically been the best team in the NBA, most consistent team in the NBA. They've, like, the way that Quinn Snyder has embraced the three-point shot has been talked about so much. The way that they've embraced the need to push it in transition has been talked about. And these are tangible changes that you can just look at the head coach who's been there forever and has a ton of success playing the way that they had, for him to acknowledge that they needed to kind of change things a little bit in a way that could make them better and make the collective better. Like, he deserves so much credit. And so, like, they've been number one in net rating like the whole year by by 1 or 2 points. And so it's just, from that perspective, like, it's just very easy to just say that Quinn Snyder has been the best coach in the league. So if anyone who wants to vote for him or thinks he's number one, like, I'm not going to totally argue with you.
Vote for him. Michael, speaking of double digits, I think they lead the league with 34 double-digit victories, if I'm not mistaken. Something absurd like that. They have just normalized dominance, right? And I think they've gotten to the point where it's sort of like boring for people. They have a top 10 point differential in the last decade. And you compare the other teams who are in that mix, you know, it's like Kevin Durant and the Thunder. It's Golden State Warriors dynasty. It's, you know, Tim Duncan and the Spurs. These are all teams that have, like, no-brainer first ballot Hall of Fame guys, you know, title, you know, winning type teams. Mm-hmm. And you look at his group, no disrespect to Donovan Mitchell or Rudy Gobert, it's definitely possible those guys wind up in the Hall of Fame. They're not at that same stage, you know, as those other teams that, you know, who are kind of comparable to them from a dominance standpoint. To me, the best argument for Quinn Snyder is this. They have not exceeded expectations as much as a team like Phoenix or a team like New York with Thibodeau, but the leap that they made from good to great is the hardest leap that there is to make, right? And they are, you know, regular season statistics would say they are great. Top five offense, top five defense, number one point differential, number one winning percentage, top 10 point differential over the last decade. That is what we would say is a great team. It's very reminiscent to Bud's first year with the Milwaukee Bucks. And I think that he was a deserving Coach of the Year winner that year. And of course, people are going to nitpick after the fact and say, come on, look what happened in the playoffs. To me, I don't take that into account. I view these as regular season awards based solely on this season. I think the other knock on Snyder might be, well, oh, he's had it easy, right? They haven't had as much disruption in their lineup as a lot of these other teams. And that's completely true. But they did have a major disruption last March when Rudy Gobert tested positive and Donovan Mitchell tested positive, and those guys were kind of at odds for, you know, a pretty extended stretch there before they finally patched things up. And for Snyder to oversee all of that, you know, endure a really tough first round exit where they're kind of shorthanded against Denver and bring them back with this level of focus and just get awesome contributions from basically everybody in his rotation because his systems work so well. I don't see a weakness here. To me, it's a bulletproof argument, and it's just harder to do what Utah's done than, you know, basically what anyone else has done. And they've done it in a year where it's even more difficult than usual, given all the challenges. So I say Quinn Snyder, coach of the year, number one. Make your case for Tom Thibodeau.
Okay. So you just said that the hardest thing to do in basketball is go from very good to great. And usually I'll agree with that. You know what's harder? Going from being the New York Knicks for the past 10 years to having home court advantage in the first round of the playoffs if the season ended today. That's what happened to the New York Knicks this year under Tibbs. He's been ridiculous, okay? They have not had a defense above 15th in the league since 2011, and normally they finish in the bottom 10. This year they've been top 5 basically the entire season. That is 100% because of Tibbs. I don't care who is on the roster. I don't care. Like, it's Tibbs. That's just coaching. Anyone who's watched the Knicks this year versus last year knows that. But the stats that I want to throw at you right now that really, I was looking at them and it was really hard for me to kind of go against what they were telling me. I mean, you can look at the preseason over-under for New York, which was 21.5.
I know, they might double it. I mean, they probably won't, but it's like in play.
Yeah, right now they're 34-27. Like, that's silly. But on cleaningtheglass.com, you can look at spread differential, which measures point differential versus what the Vegas spread would be, which is essentially like how you've exceeded expectations. And that's how I personally view coach of the year, more so than who has the most success with their team, because I think a lot of factors go into that. But yeah, when there's a turnaround,
no surprise, you're going for narrative and overachievement rather than just raw success and victories. No surprise there, Michael.
Okay. So New York leads the NBA in spread differential this season. Last year, the Raptors led the NBA in spread differential. Who won Coach of the Year last year?
Nick Nurse. So is your new catch-all metric, the Coach of the Year efficiency rating?
The year before, the Bucks led the NBA in spread differential. Who won Coach of the Year that year?
Was it Bud? I thought that was 2018. Am I mistaken?
It was Bud. The year before that, Utah led the league in spread differential. In second was the Toronto Raptors. Who won Coach of the Year that year?
Dwayne Casey?
Correct.
So don't we have a makeup call here for Quinn? Because you're telling me he got screwed 3 years ago.
you're really killing my buzz here. So, no, we can't give makeup calls. But the point here is that spread differential is a really great stat just to kind of outline how a team has exceeded expectations. No team has exceeded expectations more than the New York Knicks this season. I don't think anyone would argue with that. The way that they've exceeded expectations, you can look at Julius Randle for sure, who's played out of his mind and hit a ridiculous number of threes, way more than I ever thought I would see him hit in a season. But I would say that most of their success is attributed to how effective they've been on the defensive end and how they've embraced the plodding, methodical style that Tibbs is known for. So I look at him and I think he is synonymous with their turnaround in a way that no head coach is synonymous with their other team's success in the league. And so he has really separated himself in this debate for me.
Very well argued, despite all my, like, you know, kind of fake criticisms of you. Look, I wrote this up for the Washington Post, you know, this week for my newsletter. I think that he has the cleanest narrative, right? I mean, if you're talking about just like impact, it's almost like not quite to a LeBron level, but I mean, to turn a team from, you know, expectations being 14th to fourth in the conference, that is like sort of LeBron going from Miami to Cleveland, right? It's almost on that level in terms of like just taking a franchise and completely overhauling it at 1 year. Do we nitpick at all because of the Eastern Conference factor, Michael? I mean, for a lot of the season, that fourth seed was like underwater, under 500 in the East. You know, Boston and Miami, two other teams who we would have expected to be better than New York. You know, are we giving credit to the Knicks because these other teams have kind of underperformed their talent and expectations because of the COVID weirdness and injury issues and bubble hangovers and all of that? If New York was the sixth seed, for example, and that could still happen. I mean, they're definitely not locked in as the four seed. Are you still banging the Thibodeau drum? Like, what does he need to do to bring this thing home, I guess, is the best way to put it. Do they have to be the four seed for him to win this?
No, not at all. Like, I don't really care that much about seedings this year, especially when they're separated by a game or two. Like, come on. Like, who cares? The way I look at it more is, like, why are they good? The fact that they're going to make the playoffs and avoid the play-in when, like, I mean, heading into this season, if I told you that the Knicks were going to make the playoffs straight up, you would have looked at me like I was an insane person.
100%. Like, nobody saw this coming. Look, Vegas wasn't the only ones thinking, oh yeah, 21.5 wins. You look at the roster on paper, it makes no sense. I'm just saying, avoid the jumping to conclusions here and assumptions, Michael. They could still be in that play-in mix. It's possible. They're only two games up on that seven seed.
Look, anything's possible, but I, you know, I watched their game against the Toronto Raptors over the weekend. That was just like a clinic. I mean, I watch a lot of Knicks basketball, but like that game was so impressive to me, the way they pulled away at the end against a relatively healthy Raptors team. And I don't know, like you just, it's like the pieces that are on the floor right now for the Knicks that are getting it done: Taj Gibson, Derrick Rose, Nerlens Noel, who's just like a low-key, like one of the best defenders in the NBA this season. Like, it is wild, honestly, just like what this team looks like and how they played.
I mean, going back to trust issues, this is really going to last? Can we ask that question too? Like, I mean, I don't know what it's going to look like in the playoffs. I'm sure they're going to be a tough out for somebody. I'm not sure anyone's like, I'm not sure the top three teams are necessarily afraid of them, though. But are we looking at a situation where there's going to be some real hard regression next year, and we kind of look back on this and it was like, yeah, we all got a little too carried away with the Knicks. Isn't that kind of possible? I mean, they're under 500 pretty clearly on the road. We're not sure they totally have a franchise-level player. I wouldn't put Randall in that category yet. RJ Barrett's made some awesome strides, but I wouldn't put him in that category yet either. Are you just getting carried away by this 9-game winning streak and people dancing in the city near you, Michael? I mean, you know, do you need to pump the brakes a little bit here and really reward Quinn for what's been a dominant 5-year stretch of winning basketball?
No, well, Doug, this is the 2020-2021 regular season that we're judging. I don't care about what would happen in the past or what happened in the future.
Fair enough. Can I ask you one question? Stepping back from all this and our personal rankings, who do you think will win? And do you think that this idea of regular season skepticism, in other words, hey, Coach Bud won it in Milwaukee, but they fell apart in the playoffs, or, you know, D'Antoni's won it in the past, but his team kind of fell apart in the playoffs, like, will that start to drive how voters view this race in any way, right? Like, I could see maybe Quinn Snyder, that would be a knock on him. It's like, well, they're just a regular season team, you know? Why are we going to give this award? They're not really the best team in the league, you know? And personally, I would put both of the LA teams right now probably above the Jazz in my power rankings for most likely to win the title. So it's a defensible opinion to have some skepticism of the Jazz. Do you think this notion of, like, are they really built for the playoffs, will that impact this race at all? Because I don't think it really applies to Thibodeau, because like you're saying, everyone will say, well, they weren't even supposed to be in the playoffs, so who cares, right? But maybe a team like Utah or even Phoenix could see their coaching candidates kind of held back by that.
I don't think it'll affect this year's race, but if the Jazz were to lose in one of the first two rounds, which is totally possible, like if they don't reach the conference finals, I don't think that would shock anybody. But if that were to happen where they miss out, they don't win two playoff series, I think in the future, no matter what Utah does in the regular season, there will be a little bit of a blemish there, which would hurt Quinn's case in future Coach of the Year races. But right now, I can't look ahead like that. I don't think that's fair to him.
All fair enough, Michael. So who's going to win this thing?
Man, I think it's a coin flip between Tibbs and Snyder. Like, I know at the top you were talking about how there's all these different candidates that could kind of muck up the race. I think it's two horses, and it is so hard to pick between between the two of them. Like, neither would shock me at all. I'm going to go Tibbs just because New York, I hate to say it, but, like, I do wonder how much that matters. And I do think that a lot of Utah's success and, like, when Utah was kind of at the forefront of our conversations, like, that was a while ago, and New York has been really hot lately. I think that that'll matter. So I gotta go with Tibbs.
The Jazz peaked too early is what you're saying. Michael, are you accusing me of bringing some nags into this horse race? Is that what you're saying? Come on, man. I had good candidates. I think everybody deserved mention here. This wasn't like they're stragglers. I think it's a good race.
I think it's a fascinating race just because so many of the best coaches in the league are on teams where they just have no chance. Like, I think Eric Spoelstra is the best coach. I think Pop's a great coach. I think Rick Carlisle's a great coach. Brad Stevens, Nick Nurse, like, you can go on and on and on. None of those coaches are in here. Yeah. Steve Kerr.
that's really
a fascinating thing about it.
It's a great point. The top five or six coaches might not even be candidates this year, you know, maybe even more. Couple other guys I want to shout out quickly before this turns into too much of a love fest. James Borrego with Charlotte. I think he's kind of in that Taylor Jenkins mode to me where he gets every last drop of lemonade out of his lemons. Congratulations to him for that. And I would also say Frank Vogel still having the number one defense for the Lakers despite not having the two stars for that long. And of course, the offense has fallen apart completely without LeBron, so he doesn't really factor into this conversation. But he does deserve a level of credit for keeping them at least somewhat respectable here. But I think your point on Ty Lue, if there's going to be one guy from LA this year who's a real candidate, it would certainly be Lue. And even that's a stretch. All right, Michael, I think we should shift gears here a little bit to most improved player. And I expect that you're going to be interested in this because you're looking up all these new statistics about overachievement and who's going to be able to, like, you know, blow away the preseason Las Vegas prognosticators in terms of where we thought they would land. And that's sort of the most improved player. So I need you to square this for me, Michael, because I'm under the impression that you hate the most improved player. And every time I try to make you make picks before the season, you push back and say it's so dumb and it's a waste of time and blah, blah, blah. And yet now you're armed with these stats. So have you started to come around here a little bit? Is this a category worth more careful examination than you've given it here in the last couple of years?
I still think relative to all the other awards, it's probably my least favorite. Although I don't like Sixth Man of the Year either. I've come to the conclusion. So
yeah, Sixth Man of the Year definitely kind of sucks too. I mean, too formulaic. I wish we had a greater diversity of candidate types in that one.
Mm-hmm.
I do think that people just go to like points per game for bench player, and that's like the entire conversation most years.
Yeah, absolutely. And so my number one thing with most improved that really kind of grinds my gears is just like there's so many candidates who are in their second or third year. And it's just like people. Like these players are supposed to have progression that is reflected statistically, either in the fact that they're playing more minutes or they are going from a 19-year-old to a 21-year-old. Like they are supposed to get better. They're supposed to improve. So I don't know why we reward it. I would much rather reward someone who's going into his eighth year and he's added some really neat part of his game. And those conversations are way more interesting to me. But
so
unfortunately,
you just,
those
you
aren't
just
the ones
tipped
we have.
Your hand, buddy. I mean, you're giving it to Randall.
I'm actually not.
You don't have lie. I mean, you just said you were.
I'm not. I'm not giving it to Julius Randle. Although, if I had to predict who will win the award, I think he will.
It's going to be a New York Knicks clean sweep out here, Michael.
I'm not. He's on my top three candidates list for sure, but he's not my number one.
Well, give me your number one. I'm waiting with bated breath because you're telling me that it has to be an older player who's been around and established and made a jump here, which wipes out a bunch of the top candidates. I would suspect, I mean, I think Zion's got an interesting case, but he's right in that kind of mix of guys that you would hate to reward because he's going from year one to year two. And he was injured in year one and missed half of it. So that's an even weirder wrinkle there. Michael Porter Jr., I think, has got to be in this mix in terms of his impact on winning. His defensive commitments definitely stepped up, and just his overall role has been big time increase for Denver. So if it's not guys like that, who is it?
Joel Embiid.
Oh, Michael, come on.
I have a really good case for him. I mean,
well, I'll listen to it, but I mean, this is kind of insulting to him.
Tell me. First of all, okay, tell me why you are so down on Joel Embiid winning Most Improved Player.
Because when you're in high school and they give you Most Improved Player, that's because you stopped drinking so much Capri Sun at halftime that you have to go to the bathroom during the second half, and then you actually like locked in, focused, and played the sport for once, and like you kind of knew where you were going. It's a kind of a pat your player on the head award. You know, good job, good effort. Joel Embiid has graduated out of that. Even before he played his first NBA game, he shouldn't have been eligible for this award.
No, the way I see it, and you brought this up when you were talking about the Utah Jazz and Quinn Snyder, the hardest thing to do in the NBA is to go from very good to great.
But you didn't like that argument, Michael.
I did not say that. I said I agree with you, but I was citing a particular outlier that is the New York Knicks, the James Dolan New York Knicks.
Okay, fair.
So with Joel Embiid, I think heading into this season, you and I and a lot of other people had the same feelings about Joel Embiid, which were that he is an incredible talent, very effective basketball player, could be dominant. There was a lot of parts of his game, though, that were missing. He was very good. He wasn't great. This version of Joel Embiid that we've seen this season, this was not a guarantee that he would ever get here. And for him to go from very good all-star to, if he were healthy, he would easily win MVP, that's the type of leap that I'm talking about that I think we should reward more often, and we should celebrate, because there are particular parts of his game, specific parts of his game, that have gotten better, that have allowed him to be this best player in the world candidate, which he was not at any other point in his career. And we've talked about them a bunch, you know, the mid-range shooting, his ability to draw fouls, the conditioning, the three-point shot. There's just a lot of different parts of his game that have gotten better. How he reads double teams, the turnovers are down, the usage is up. I mean, he's averaging 7 more points per game than he did last season. Like, it's just obvious to me that he's gotten so much better as a basketball player, and I want to celebrate that. So that's why I'm picking him for Most Improved Player.
Will you do me a favor? Write this column tonight and circulate it to the Philadelphia local media. I need to see this reaction, Michael. I think that we're just kind of in a down part of the season right now. There's not enough going on. I think you just need to shake the snow globe a little bit here and get everybody real worked up and excited about this. It's interesting because Giannis is a guy who gets compared to Embiid a lot, you know, in terms of like who's better, where do they rank, you know, kind of carrying Eastern Conference franchises. And Giannis did win Most Improved Player. And I thought at the time it was a very deserving win. And, you know, I'm speaking hypocritically here, I actually thought the next year, when after his Most Improved Player season, he could have won it again because all of his stats went completely up across the board. And I think that year might have been his first MVP year, or maybe that was another year down the road. But it is true that superstar elite players can demonstrate major important improvements from year to year. I'm just asking you, is that really in keeping with the spirit of this award? Are you still feeling like you're like you could look yourself in the mirror after you made this pick, or is this just kind of a take, Michael?
No, this is legit. Like, first of all, what is this? How would you describe? I guess you already did describe to me what the spirit of Most Improved Player is.
Yeah, no, it's going like, to take a guy who's been sort of okay, you know, has a big breakout, kind of changes our perception of him. You know, he's going to get himself a bigger contract in the future. That's sort of how I look at it. Or I do actually a lot of times pick younger players where, you know, Zion's not guaranteed to play as well as he did this year coming off of his rookie year. And so I would tend to, you know, really highly value that. I mean, Michael Porter, I think, was my preseason pick, and he's been almost exactly what I expected, even better in some ways. So I think that he would really have a strong case too. But I keep I keep coming back to Randall.
Okay, but real quick about Michael Porter Jr. So this is his second year, right? Like, why would you reward him for taking a role? He's going to take more minutes in a larger role because Jeremy Grant left. So, like, what are we celebrating here? Like, what part of his game has improved? that
nothing is guaranteed, Michael. You can't just run this like a computer simulation and say Jeremy Grant's out, therefore Michael Porter Jr. is going to have these numbers just drastically increase. We see disappointments across the league all the time, guys who don't step up. He's basically doubled his scoring average. He's shooting 44% on three-pointers. Doubling the number of three-point attempts per game. He has made progress on defense ever since you coached him up. You know, he's hitting the glass more. You know, he's showing demonstrable improvement. He's way more important to the Nuggets this year and their winning formula than he was last year. Last year, he was a bit player. This year, he's a central guy, and he's on his way to a max contract.
Ben, you just said he's doubled his points, which is correct. He has literally doubled his minutes. I mean, like, do you understand where I'm coming from, at least?
Is it called economies of scale, Michael, where sometimes, you know, you go back to that cornfield, it's twice as big, but you don't get twice as much corn out of it? That's just not necessarily how it works. You want it to work that way. If we gave everybody more minutes, we'd always get more points out of them, but it doesn't. And apologies to any economists out there if I screwed that up. That's, you know, that's a callback from 20 years ago. But I just don't think it's so formulaic where, like, okay, well, we predicted that this was going to happen. Well, good. It's nice to feel good about our predictions and be proven true by a player who had obvious breakout potential. But he is way more important and way more central to one of the Western Conference's best teams than I expected at this point. Like, you know, I still thought... And part of that's the Murray injury, and part of that is how they've reconfigured around Aaron Gordon. But he's been awesome, and I think he's deserving of the recognition. I'm not going to vote for him, but I just think that he's like your more stereotypical most improved player candidate. I know that grinds your gears, but
yes,
I guess
it does.
Okay, so this isn't personal to Michael Porter Jr. for you. You just think that that kind of a framework should be done away with.
Correct. And when I was sitting down and I was putting some of the names together, Zion is such an outlier that, like, I'll accept people who are like, okay, the leap that he made is superhuman.
He's top five in win shares. That's the thing. Like, I don't think people would have predicted, even like the best case scenario for Zion, they wouldn't have said on a losing team he's going to come through with top five in win shares. The only guys ahead of him are Jokic, Gobert, Giannis, and Kawhi right now. That's ridiculous.
No, he's totally unstoppable.
He doesn't play defense. That's part of the problem. I can't vote for Zion until he can give me a little bit more on that and his team can win a little bit. So that's why I come back to Randall, because I think he checks not only statistical improvement, obvious skill improvement from the three-point shot. I don't trust that's going to stay at all, by the way, but I've got to give credit to him that he's doing it right now. It's translated to wins in a way that I definitely didn't expect. If you took him off that team, they would feel it deeply, right? And you know, and it's more of a later career guy where you can say, like, yeah, this, he obviously put a lot of time into his game during this 8-month shutdown for the Knicks and came back as a different player, changed his reputation, rightfully was a first-time All-Star. You know, at the end of the day, I mean, it was really close, but I think he's proven that he deserved that in the time since, hasn't fallen off like your guy LaVine. So I would say, you know, worthy most improved player winner. I would not be upset if he won it, would you?
I mean, Randall's going to win. I think that that is almost open and shut here. And the case is just like, it's so easy to, I mean, just look at the improvement that he made as a three-point shooter. I mean, he leads the league in minutes. He's 24, 10, and 6. The assists are double what they've ever been in his career up to this point. I have a stat for you real quick.
I have a hypothetical for you before you get to your stat. Okay. If you go onto a Zoom call and you tell Joel Embiid, Joel, you know, I know you're in the mix for MVP. You've campaigned for yourself as MVP, but I think you've improved more than Julius Randle. What do you think? How is that playing? Like, is he coming through the screen after you, or is he agreeing and saying, you know what? I'm glad you recognize that. I really have improved my game. Is he disrespected by the comparison to Julius Randle, who's never done anything in the playoffs? How is he responding to that?
I can't get into Joel Embiid's head. I would assume, based on the campaigning that he's been doing, that MVP is on his mind and Defensive Player of the Year even are on his mind far more than Most Improved Player. So if he were to go home with just that trophy, I don't think he would be excited about it. But like, the Most Improved Player trophy is, in my opinion, worth celebrating if you earn it in the way that he has or Randall has, more so than Michael Porter Jr. or Zion or Luka last year or Trae Young last year or whoever you want to give it to.
Luka should have won last year, and I'm glad.
Jesus.
No, he definitely should. I mean, it's the good to great leap, man. That is a really hard thing to do. If Zion could play a little bit more defense, I think I'd be on the Zion train. But you know, we're getting there. Maybe next year he can win it. Any other kind of fringe candidates that percolated for you? I am blown away by this Embiid pick. It's probably going to ruin my week, honestly. who else do you have in your mix?
I have a bunch of names.
What
I guess
about
I'll
LeBron?
Start.
You know,
Jesus,
just messing with you.
What
about Steph Curry? Could you make a case for Steph Curry?
No, you can't make a case for Steph Curry.
Michael,
sorry.
He's shooting like 47% on threes. Best month of his career. NBA record most threes in April. Never been done before. Eclipsing James Harden. 85. He's still got 5 days to go to add to that tally. We've never seen a better Steph Curry. It's inarguable that he's improved. Everybody swears by his leadership. Steve Kerr says he can't even come up with new words. He's exhausted synonym.com in trying to describe Steph Curry's performance. Should he be in this mix?
He should not. I'm sorry. Steph's been great, but let's hold your horses. Like in 2000, I mean, this is a unanimous MVP winner here, a 3-time champion. Like,
but he's
down.
Better.
Okay, cool. So who I was going to say is Jaylen Brown with the Celtics.
Great one. He was the early leader. What happened there?
Well, Joel Embiid caught up, man. What can I say?
Oh, Jesus.
What happened? I don't know. I mean, like, he came out of the gate, like, shooting, what, like 70% from the mid-range? Something absolutely ridiculous that boosted his numbers. He hasn't... I wouldn't say he's fallen off necessarily. I would say that the Celtics, their struggles really, you know, that puncture any award case for anyone on the team this season, as it probably should. But Jaylen's been really good. He's improved his passing, playmaking, ball handling, his shooting, everything, and the numbers are up across the board. So, like, his case is really solid to me.
Yeah, and I think if you're going forward for the next 5 years, who would you rather have, Jaylen or Julius Randle?
Are you asking me personally?
Yeah.
Jaylen.
Well, it's a leading question because I wanted you to say Jaylen because that's the right answer. So maybe we should be voting for Jaylen over Julius Randle.
Well, that is a completely different argument than most improved player. But
I'm just saying, like, if we put this into context and say, all right, well, whose improvements are going to be lasting and are going to be more meaningful and who's kind of changed who they are?
I mean,
Jaylen came in and he didn't even get the max, you know? And there was a lot of debate, by myself included, saying, well, he's not a well-rounded enough offensive player to deserve that contract. I think he's put a lot of that talk to the side. Now looks like a great value deal. Actually, same can be said for Julius Randle, by the way. You know, his contract went from kind of cringy when he signed it because he seemed like an empty calorie player to, you know, looking like a great deal right now as well, you know, a year or two later. But maybe we shouldn't be discounting Jaylen Brown.
Well, when Jaylen signed his contract, I was on record as saying that it was a deal for the Celtics. So that argument doesn't really carry too much water with me. But I do think that I 100% agree with you what you're saying about Randle, though, and his contract and how everyone was kind of laughing at it when it was signed. Maybe not everyone, but me. And like when I look at Randle, I have a lot of respect for him and the way that he's played this season. If he shoots over 40% from the three-point line next season, too, I would say I got to be surprised. I'm not going to lie.
Yeah, no, I think he's a very natural regression candidate. He's just been red, red, red hot. You know how Kobe used to issue the challenges to players to win different awards? Like he challenged, he challenged Jokic to win MVP. He challenged some other guys to win different awards. Do you want to know who I'm going to challenge for next year?
Who?
Brandon Ingram. Okay, I want a second most improved player award out of Brandon Ingram because I've just been so kind of disappointed with him this year. And look, I'm always going to link him with Randall, but imagine if Brandon Ingram had a Randall-like breakthrough where it's like, yes, I'm just going back to being this takeover guy. It's probably going to involve a trade. I'm going to lock in a lot more. No, Randle's not the world's greatest defender, but like he's not lost and just, you know, very inattentive like a player like Brandon Ingram. There's a lot more untapped potential to me in Brandon Ingram than we've seen so far. And so I'm challenging him. That's my challenge for next year's Most Improved Player Award. Show it to me again, Brandon Ingram.
You got to stop picking on Brandon Ingram. I don't know what he did to you. He's fine.
He's fine. He should be a lot better than fine, Michael. He is supremely talented, and it's really not working. And I'm not going to all blame him, but I do think it starts with his effort level.
Okay. Clint Capella. Love Clint Capella. He should finish on some Defensive Player of the Year ballots, and he leads the league in offensive and defensive rebounding.
Has he gotten better? Is it a bounce back season? You know, it's kind of a weird year, not really a great personality fit. He was the scapegoat in Houston. I liked that trade for Atlanta at the time, although it was kind of, you know, debated. Is he really better or is it just a better fit?
I think he's better, to be honest. Like you look at just the fact that he's no longer with, I know Trae Young is a really good playmaker, pick and roll, lob thrower and reads the floor really well. But like Clint Capella gets the ball in spaces where he did not in Houston, and he's forced to kind of put it on the ground a little bit, make some stuff happen when he's not just spoon-fed at the rim, and he's done a pretty good job. But I honestly think that the way that he's improved the most is on the defensive end, where Atlanta does not have him switching every single ball screen as he did for the majority of his career with Houston. And him as just a drop guy, more traditional, protecting the rim. He's just been terrific. And so I honestly didn't see a future for him where he's leading the league in rebounding with legitimate rebounds that are contested. Like that wasn't something that I ever saw for him. So I just want to shout him out because he's been the most consistent player on Atlanta this year, and Atlanta is a very, very good team.
You think he's going to get locked out of all defense?
I really hope not, but I could see. I mean, Gobert's going to get
Gobert
one spot.
Gobert and Embiid is tough. I mean, should they remove positions from both all NBA and all defense?
Well, yes. Yeah. Yes.
Because Embiid's probably going to get locked out of all NBA first team too, and that doesn't really seem all that fair this season.
No, I agree with you. I'm more concerned with defensive team than anything because, first of all, like Capella's been better on defense on aggregate than Embiid, in my opinion. And there's obviously the missed games factor. So, like, if Capella doesn't get it, I think that would be a real shame because he's been one of the two best defensive centers in the league all season long.
Yeah, I guess Embiid just needs to improve a little bit more, Michael. Well, there's still plenty of time for that. do you have any other final nominations before we wrap this up?
I'll throw a couple names at you. We don't need to go too deep into them. Terry Rozier, yep. DeJounte Murray, Zach LaVine, your boy, yep. Jeremy Grant.
No.
That's more of
come
the...
Come on. No. Come on.
Okay. You cannot say that there is nothing guaranteed with Michael Porter Jr.
Well, that's what I was
going to
say. If you're
going to
discount Michael Porter Jr., you can't give me Jeremy Grant, who's done it all meaningless games.
No, I can, though, because Jeremy Grant is now the number one option. His role has completely shifted. I don't care that he's on a bad team. That was his decision to go there.
No, look, he's not a number one option. He's their leading scorer. He is not a number one option. There's a big difference.
Okay, so he has, I would say, I'm not going to vote for him, but I would put him in this list here.
Only if it's 20 candidates. I mean, honestly, okay, like only sure. if we're just well, randomly picking names from a hat.
I'm throwing a lot of names at you, so okay. He's one of them. And the last name I'll throw out there, who, in my opinion, has been the most overlooked player, maybe not overlooked, the most overlooked, like, legitimate star this season, is Bam Adebayo.
Wow.
And I, you know, Bam was second last year behind Ingram, barely finished second, and he's just still improving. It's pretty wild. If you look at how he played last year versus this year, he's a completely different basketball player in a lot of ways. And the numbers back it up. And the way Miami has played defense backs it up. The guy switches literally every ball screen, and he's a starting center. Like I don't really know what to say about Bam. He's terrific. But Miami has struggled for a lot of different reasons, not because of him in any way. And I think he's suffered for it.
Yeah, it's tough for those big guys to get the respect. I mean, you know, when they're so relying upon backcourt and lead playmaker, perimeter playmakers for the offense, like, you can be as good as you want on defense these days, but like, if your offense is bottom 10 and you're just doing your job night after night, game after game, it's very just warping and distorting for those guys to kind of get their attention. So I love that nomination from you. And surprise, surprise, I love the nomination of Zach LaVine. I think this is the right kind of category for a player like Zach. He's definitely improved, took a major step forward in terms of his scoring volume. Had a nice run there carrying the Bulls before things have kind of fallen apart here lately, and in part because he missed some time as well. So you can say, all right, well, his impact is there. To me, did he make the leap into stardom? No. But he definitely made a leap, and I think he should be on a lot of ballots. Personally, I'd still favor Randall in this conversation. I think Zion's got a strong case. I think Michael Porter Jr., I think those three guys would probably be my top three, but I love the Rozier mention as well. All right, Michael, hopefully I wasn't too hard on you in some of these arguments today. No hard feelings. Mostly I was just joking around, besides the Embiid pick, which was crazy. But I do like it when you go outside the box, and please write that one for all the great readers at SI.com to rip to shreds. It would be very, very fun. I want to see your mentions, Michael, don't you?
I already, you know, my Embiid quota, I think, has been filled for the season. I would not feel comfortable writing two Embiid columns in the same month, but I think it's a good suggestion by you.
Yeah, pace yourself. Definitely pace yourself. All right, guys, we've reached the end of another episode of Open Floor. Invariably, Michael and I miss some names in these conversations. So who do you have for Coach of the Year? Who do you have for Most Improved Player? And which other races are you tracking very carefully? I know everybody's got their eye on the MVP, but Michael, I think there's a lot of other interesting races that are unfolding right before our eyes. Email us, openfloormail@gmail.com. openfloormail@gmail.com. Michael's on Instagram and Twitter at Michael V as in Victor Pina. I'm on Instagram at Ben.Golliver, on Twitter at Ben.Golliver. You guys can find us on Apple Podcasts by searching for Open Floor. That's two words. When you find our page, scroll down. It will say rate and review. Tap 5 stars. It's just that easy to help us spread the word. All right, Michael, until later this week, I will talk to you.
Talk soon, Ben.
How do people feel about getting Big Fitness Energy at Planet Fitness for $15 a month? They feel as thrilled as a kid the first summer they're tall enough to ride the roller coaster. That's right. When you join Planet Fitness right now, you get access to tons of equipment and free fitness training in a clean and spacious club. Don't wait. Join the judgment-free zone today for that all-day energy. Download the free Planet Fitness app and join today for $15 a month.
Hurry. Deal ends September 12th. Join today for $15 a month.
See Home Club for details.